Blog Talk Radio.
Home Companion from the get-go. That rendition, of course, is 1924. Just sets the mood. Something that was so inspiring at the time, and hard not to say that Louis Armstrong has faded from memory. Hello, I'm your host for another hour or so of conversation and revelations and all things Masonic, and of course, I need your assistance with so many questions. I can't possibly figure out all of these quandaries that occur. I hope you've been doing well since we've last met. I want to just bring you up to date, and don't let me forget, tonight I have to mention the Sankey Lecture coming up this Sunday at Brock University. I think it's scheduled for 3 o'clock. Be there or be square. That's a ticket that is well worth it. And tonight, I have to. And I promise you, I'll talk a little bit about the work of Joy Porter, who's going to be the speaker at the Sankey Lecture, Dr. Porter, Professor Porter. Just incredible. And she's talking on Native American Freemasonry. Again, probably a little bit of an eye-opener for a lot of us, that and I think it goes on to validate the challenge that's been put to us, that the ideas about Freemasonry, the principles, everything about Freemasonry, I believe was started by scholarly fellows. And the scholarship didn't stop, or that wasn't branded when Freemasonry fell under the organization of Grand Lodges, no more than it did before that, when lodges existed without that kind of coordinated structure. So fast forward 300 years, and the amount of information, we are told, in the hands of scholars is greater than what is in the hands of Freemasons today. I can well believe it. A lot of what I read, when I was a little new Freemason, was to dive into some of the older materials, and then some of Lomas' work that was really Knights and Lomas, was that? Really interesting. Some conjecture in it, but a lot of really interesting facts. And now we see Lomas has gone on to really, I think, focus more on a scholastically qualified version. I loved his early work when I was new in Freemasonry, and I certainly appreciate his work today, his latter work. And I think some of it is brilliant. And I advise you to Robert Lomas, go and take a look. Google that, or get to your local bookstore, or put the tap on a Masonic friend. Really good stuff. But the notion that the branding is where the boundaries of knowledge has started and stopped. It I just think that's a bit daft, if you don't mind me saying. So I think that's a polite word. Of course, scholarship. These ideas are sharp. And they're beautiful ideas, the concepts. And thank goodness that scholars have continued to pursue them, develop them, and to present their findings. The information that we have today, in so many ways, is more, what's the word, detailed, has more depth than ever before. That's the note of progress. Funny that that we seem to struggle with the advance of progress on one hand. We look forward to it, especially if somebody that we care about is sick. I want the best and the latest and the newest, the best science involved. But then again, we have this interesting phenomena, so too many, I think, that wraps us in this blindfold of sentimentalism. And nothing wrong with being sentimental, but certainly there is when it blocks our view of the horizon. There is so much more. I can like my old pair of shoes. I can like my Volkswagen Beetle, 1966, for what it was then. You couldn't give it to me on a bet right now compared to the car that I drive. Modern, safe, convenient, comfortable, no comparison. Would I take a Studebaker Hawk? In a heartbeat. But that's just an appreciation of, I think, great engineering and great design. It's not to say the design that of today captures the bee's knees. Well, that would be a bit foolish. But I appreciate the past for what it was. And you appreciate the future for what it is. The future is what we live right now. It's all we can live. It's live in the moment. If nothing else, the universality and I guess the pacifist undertones of Freemasonry teaches us these things. So while you're on that distinct treadmill, learning how important contentment and gratitude are, if you were to achieve contentment in life, it's a step toward that happiness. If you're to provide service for people, other people, you have a better chance of preserving happiness, achieving happiness. But it's not you do that without an expectation. It's like the Masonic values distinguish between us doing something because we get a little pat on the back or some gain, and doing things because it's the right thing to do. You want to be the center of every photograph? Okay, I guess you have to do that. I think there's much more to Freemasonry, and I want to talk with you this evening about that. A lot more. Freemasonry, I would suggest to you, is an order that has wonderful ideas that work best, I think, when applied to men of vision. That doesn't mean every single one of us is Charles Darwin or Newton or Wren. We are humble people in our own way. They had good ideas, sound science, and they were diligent. But at the time, they had no more sense of prescience, being able to predict the future, than you and I. Nor did the fellows that came up with these wonderful ideas that were developed into a Grand Lodge. I'm not quite sure how I reconcile the notions of Freemasonry anymore. I've been saying lately, like I did over at St. Mark's, they hosted me. We had the experience, I'll call it the experience of the ancient churches over there at that wonderful old lodge in Port Stanley. And the experience is quite remarkable. I get to feel, and I'll ask you for your advice on this, that I begin to feel that something about our fraternity, this large fraternal order, is instinctive. It's then natural. It happens because we have need for this. I don't agree that it's a political structure or it's an administrative structure. I think that's a bit simplistic. Oh, I won't argue with you if you tell me that, Graham, you know, we seem to spend a great deal of our time focusing on administrative quarrels and issues and trying to keep our financial house in order. Well, I think part of our order needs to be buttoned down and a bit rigid and about it. But does that define Freemasonry? Hell no. Only a fool would suggest something like that. There's a reverence about Freemasonry and an irreverence. It's an order of older boys that have grown into men. You bear the weight of the world and responsibility on your shoulders for decades, and you begin to stoop under the load. And then there comes a day when your knees buckle and the weight is a little more than you can carry, and that's when you realize that it's time to make an adjustment, that your day of bearing the heavy load has passed. You've done what you could when you could. There is a reverence about the order. I think the pageantry is in itself symbolic. It's very important, I think, because it lets us bear witness to a very interesting phenomena. That's where I think the expression of Freemasonry is perhaps deepest. The symbols speak to us in different ways. I'm not really good at listening to other people translate these things. It's like watching There we go. Technical block. I wonder what's going on. Sorry for the inconvenience. Skype dropped me. I'm not too sure where that dropped off, but I'll try and pick it up. Bloody hell, eh? Just when you think you have things under control. But what I'm talking about here tonight are the things that we can't always control. The things that go on. The things that go on with us or without us. It's the oddity sometimes is this struggle about change. And it's hard to understand that we struggle so much with the phenomena of change when in fact it's something that has been part of, as much a part of life as breath itself. Every stage, every step, every moment is an element and an expression of change. I wonder if these thoughts that they're the declaration that we have difficulty with change is nothing more than perhaps massaging our egos. You know, all of a sudden we have difficulty with something that is essential to the course of our lives. Everything around us, we are taught and we ought to observe, is under a constant state of flux. Everything good that we have around us will one day pass. Oh, it will be replaced by other things, equal or even better. But the memories of our experiences today will always linger. Maybe that's the immortality that we all seek. As my friend John is prone to say, everybody likes to feel special. Makes us, I think, when you reflect on it, seem foolish and threadbare, worn out, when we walk around with our chests puffed up, talking about needing to preserve something from a bygone era. No faster way to alienate ourselves from the contemporary situation than to do that. Do you ever notice when you hear a very weak argument being put forward, or a very superficial explanation of something, that it's often packaged with a temper outburst or a forcefulness. Man, if the idea was that good, wouldn't you be able to carry the thought in a whisper? One would think. Any of the listeners out there have not experienced this, or being bombastic, or somebody with a title or a rank, whether it's in Freemasonry or outside the doors of the lodge. These are ways of covering up. There are ways of covering up very poorly thought out ideas. You and me, on the other hand, have been taught to observe. Aude, vide, tace. Listen, watch, in silence. I think the last one is the hardest. That's why it was one of the first rigors of an initiate to the Pythagorean school. Now, there's an interesting fellow. Pythagoras goes over to Egypt, apparently impressed the scholars in Egypt enough that apparently they shared some of their engineering with him. So, like a good Greek, he hangs around. Probably a reasonable fellow. Probably showed a keen interest. Probably got invited into some of the mystery schools of the day. But like every expatriate, he returned home. And he brought some amazing ideas with him. The new initiates in his school, or gymnasia as they were prone to calling it, he didn't even acknowledge them for the first year, didn't talk to them. If they were around, they were often behind a screen. They were there to develop the skill of listening. Very little is known about the Pythagorean school to this day. A lot, we think, was deliberately destroyed. But why? Pythagoras at the time wasn't exactly the most popular philosopher. Why that is? I haven't studied enough to be able to tell you, but I'll get around to that one day. Pythagoras, at least, I think, was trying to explain to us the truth in mathematics. The thought that everything could be explained through mathematics. That was irrefutable, not prone to opinion or the conjecture or the vagaries of human whim or personality or popularity. It was what it was. The calculations were irrefutable. Think of how beautiful that mind was, that would attempt to pass on something perfect and beautiful. Oh, too old school, I'm sure. Now that's, I'm not sure. You help me and judge me for this. Am I being nostalgic? Never knew the man. Read a bit about the man. I'm sure there's more. But what fascinated me, of course, was the references in Masonic literature to Pythagorean thinking. If I read something or you read something, I think it only has a bearing on a Mason if it has meaning. And then, as I've said too many times, after you understand the meaning of what is being taught or said, I think you have an obligation to yourself to ask yourself what the symbol or the phrase or the story or the history says to you. I think that's really important. What does it mean? And what does it say? We're odd that way. A fraternal order of contemplation. In a world that, you know, short-sighted folks will say is speeding up. Well, world isn't speeding up. It's always spun that, well, okay. I know that it's, and you know that it's slowing down, but it's in orbit and it's spinning. Okay, and it creates a gravity. Okay. All those givens, this sense of permanence that we see around, I look around the room and I see things that are, that I can touch. The floor doesn't seem to be moving, but I'm sitting on the sphere spinning at, what, 56,000 kilometers an hour? Physics pumping into my ears, telling me that everything around is made up of molecules, and inside those molecules are atoms. And inside those atoms are contained enormous spaces. So here I am in this ether, these vapors. But this perception that I have tells me that this glass in my hand is cool to the touch and I can pick it up. You can defy gravity. The perception is really critical to making the old brain work. Just as it is, I'd say, to suggest, with Freemasonry. It's about perception. And whose perception amongst us is the right perception? We understand a fool's perception. Somebody that hasn't done his work. A superficial, thoughtless, or lazy effort. We all understand that. Particularly when you and I embrace the fact that Freemasonry is based on something that's unusual in our lives. A meritocracy. This is a cruel taskmaster. Fame and fortune and celebrity don't really cut it. Unless you're with, I don't know, people that are impressed by that type of thing. Freemasonry is an order based on a progression that thrives on merit. So when you look around, this is the buy-in with the people that we have elected to lead our order into the next millennium. Hopefully we're able to select men of vision. Meanwhile, it's curious, we squabble 45,000 middle managers talking about things that are absolutely meaningless in the big picture. Let the fellows that we've selected to do the job do their job. If they need some help from us, we give it to them when they ask. If the stuff they're doing is foolish, we shrug our shoulders and walk away and ignore them, and they'll be, you know, they'll learn. They'll learn from experience. We all do. But to undermine them, to undermine us, the effort of our brethren, this is a travesty. That's where each one of us is the expression of Masonic leadership. You lead by example. I've never seen anybody encouraged by constant criticism or ridicule. Not in this kind of order. This isn't where we snap our heels together and thumbs along the seam. No. This is much more complicated. This is commitment by choice of inner development. Not defense. Not conquering heroes. Philosophical development. Plato told us about the philosopher kings. Many also had a role for the guards, didn't they? Who also would be students of philosophy, but highly trained and well-equipped to protect our interests. Absolutely necessary, but We'll come back to some of this. I'm sitting here with all kinds of material. Where do I start with you? You know, tomorrow is the 7:02 a.m. Get up, get outside, breathe deeply. It's the 20th of March, the vernal equinox, the first day of spring. Celebrate it. Absolutely celebrate it. Equinox, fantastic. Heading toward the summer solstice. This is where we have, what? Day and night in balance? Do we have 12 hours? Between them? Equinox. And we're heading toward the longest days and shortest nights with the summer solstice. And I hope I'm on air that day too. There's just something about being able to recognize that we had lunar lodges that met on a calculation of the full moon. Fascinating. Maybe that was when we were more in touch with the universe around us. Again, am I being nostalgic? I've read that there was a time back in time when science and faith were one. What science does isn't a quarrel with faith. It's a demonstration. It's a demonstration of the beauty of creation, the discovery of the beauty of creation. I know that will upset some folk up there, and I have no intention of doing that. But a Freemason, I believe, has a responsibility to exercise and cultivate a free mind, not closed, never narrow-minded, a free mind, capable of examining things that don't sit well with us, to being able and willing to contain opposing ideas in our minds at the same time. A sign of maturity. Or not. We can continue this. I think the immaturity of having this feeling that everything we say and do and think is absolutely right. Now there's an interesting perception. There is an interesting perception. Let's hope the Freemasonry offers us more than that. When I'm talking to you, I hope that you'll have this sense that I'm always thinking about the context. What are the things out of our context that are influencing our thinking today? I don't mean, you know, having our nose pressed up to the trees so closely that we can't see the forest. I mean the trends, what's going on around us. I can't, when I read about the perils of hundreds of years ago, it makes me feel odd to think that somebody is telling me that I'm in more danger today than ever before. Well, no great beast is trying to eat my rear end because they're a little hungry. I know we're doing some interesting things to our environment, but that will soon catch up with us. And you and I both know that that's a fact. Irrefutable, isn't it? Natural law. No appeal. Just lay it out there. How about a little, you know, you ready for a little bit of excitement? Nothing when I hear that. Nothing inspires me more than a little bit of Albert Pike. Whoa. You're sitting there with a bottle of tequila. I hope you're getting toward the bottom of it because this is a little bit of heavy lifting from my friend Al, our friend Al. Interesting guy. Interesting guy. Here we go. A peasant boy guiding Blücher by the right one of two roads, the other one impassable for artillery, enables him to reach Waterloo in time to save Wellington from a defeat that would have been a rout, and so enables the kings to imprison Napoleon on a barren rock in mid-ocean. An unfaithful Smith by the slovenly shoeing of a horse causes his lameness, and he, stumbling, the career of his world-conquering rider ends, and the destinies of empires are changed. We know the horse stumbled, and we know the general died. A generous offer. See, that's Albert. He's assuming that you and I have read the history of the Battle of Waterloo. Time you did. Good time to do it, if I do say so myself. A generous officer permits an imprisoned monarch to end his game of chess before leading him to the block. And meanwhile, the usurper dies and the prisoner reascends the throne. An unskillful... Now, Albert tends to get to something, but he's very, very circumspect to how he does it. An unskillful workman, he says, repairs the compass, or malice or stupidity disarranges it. The ship mistakes her course, the waves swallow a Caesar, and a new chapter is written in the history of the world. He's saying, crap happens. A poorly shod horse, the compass broken, stuff happens. We can't always know it. So, and on board those things, some people with great potential may die. And a new chapter is written in the history of the world when that happens. What we call accident is but the adamantine chain. Oh, don't you love that word? Google the world out of this one. Adamantine. Adamantine chain of indissoluble connection between all created things. Couldn't have said it better myself, Albert. Man, the locust hatched in the Arabian sands, the small worm that destroys the cotton bowl, one making famine in the Orient and the other closing the mills and starving the workmen and their children in the Occident with riots and massacres, are as much the ministers of God as the earthquake. And the fate of nations depends more on them than on the intellect of its kings and legislators. Man who is struggling to and noticing things that we could contain, convention, honors, and then we have the unruliness of nature, the unexpected. And the fate of nations depends more on them than on the intellect of its kings and legislators. A civil war in America will end in shaking the world. And that war may be caused by the vote of some ignorant prize fighter or crazed fanatic in a city or in a Congress or of some stupid bore in an obscure country parish. The electricity of universal sympathy, of action and reaction, pervades everything, the planets and the motes and the sunbeam. Faust with his types, or Luther with his sermons, worked greater results than Alexander or Hannibal. A single thought sometimes suffices to overturn a dynasty. A silly song did more to unseat James II than the acquittal of the bishops. That's an obscure reference you want to scurry around and find. Voltaire, Condorcet, and Rousseau uttered words that will ring in change and revolutions throughout all the ages. Remember that though life is short, thought and the influences of what we do or say are immortal, and that no calculus has yet pretended to ascertain the law of proportion between cause and effect. The hammer of an English blacksmith smithing down an insolent official led to a rebellion that came near being a revolution. The word well spoken, the deed fitly done, even by the feeblest and humblest, cannot help but have their effect. More or less, the effect is inevitable and eternal. Loose talk, our loose talk. Hard to bring it back, isn't it? Hard to erase the unforeseen damage that we do. What Al is asking us to do here by all of these examples that he cites through history is to take a moment and think before we act and speak. More or less, the effect is inevitable and eternal, he says. The echoes of the greatest deeds may die away like the echoes of a cry among the cliffs, and what has been done seem to the human judgment to have been without result. The unconsidered act of the poorest of men may fire the train that leads to the subterranean mine and an empire be rent by the explosion. The power of a free people is often at the disposal of a single and seemingly an unimportant individual. A terrible and truthful power for which a people feel with one heart and therefore can lift up their myriad arms for a single blow. And again, there is no graduated skill for the measurement of the influences of different intellects upon the popular mind. Peter the Hermit held no office, yet what a work he wrought. From the political point of view, there is but a single principle, the sovereignty of man over himself. This sovereignty of oneself over oneself is called liberty. Where two or several of these sovereignties associate, the state begins. But in this association, there is no abdication. Each sovereignty parts with a certain portion of itself to form the common right. That portion is the same for all. Each one of us gives up a little bit to be a member of this order. There is equal contribution by all to the joint sovereignty. This identity of concession which each makes to all is equality. The common right is nothing more or less than the protection of all, pouring its rays on each. This protection of each by all is fraternity. Let me get into that again, huh? The common right is nothing more or less than the protection of all, pouring its rays on each. This protection of each by all is fraternity. Liberty is the summit, equality the base. Equality is not all vegetation on a level, a society of big spears of grass and stunted oaks, a neighborhood of jealousies emasculating each other. It is civilly, all aptitudes having equal opportunity. Politically, all votes having equal weight. Religiously, all consciences having equal rights. Equality has an organ, gratuitous and obligatory instruction. We must begin with the right to the alphabet, the primary school obligatory upon all, the higher school offered to all. Such is the law. From the same school for all springs equal society. Instruction, light, comes from light, and all returns to it. I'm going to stop. Not because I'm done, not because Albert's done, but because Albert is like, it's like oysters. It's fantastic, but it needs to be savored. It's not something we want to flip through. It's not really that kind of material. It's material for the contemplative types amongst us. So let me continue on with that theme, if you're okay with that. I hope you don't mind. You've been very generous so far tonight. I want to get into something here. Whoops. This is from the volume 86 of Ars Quatuorum Coronatum. Coronatorum. There you go. For the year 1973. And, you know, that's the Research Lodge number 2076 in London, the premier lodge of Masonic research. And this is work that was edited back then by Roy A. Wells, Masonic Worship Master. The part I want to talk to you about, if you don't mind, is from Roy Wells himself. He edited it, but he put in a supplement, or Miscellanea Latimorum, for all of you people that have sense of Latin, which we all should, I think. This is an introduction to the structure of Freemasonry. I think you'll find it interesting. You listen to the likes of me, and I'll try and convince you that the Royal Society had something to do with it. I'm not quite sure that I buy that the philosophies and arts and knowledge of the liberality and harmony would necessarily come from illiterate laborers in the quarries. Not to say that it couldn't, but the likelihood of that happening, I'd be lying if I said it was an everyday occurrence. That would be rare. There is scarcely a case of difficulty can occur in the lodge. There is scarcely a case of difficulty can occur in the lodge in which that book will not set you right. Oh, so says the installing master to his successor on handing over a copy of the Book of Constitutions. But human nature remains quite unpredictable and refuses to be confirmed within a given set of regulations. Confined within a given set of regulations, and as any past master will tell you, the case of difficulty not covered by that book was the one that happened during his year of office. Isn't that the truth? You've been sitting in the East, what you learn, the unexpected always happens at the last minute, and every single time we survive. Boys are great. And they survive. If they're fortunate and the gentlemen around them are tasteful, they don't grouse and complain like, dare I say, old women. Don't say that out loud. God may be listening, and she'll get really ticked off. Many cases of difficulty exist outside the scope of official regulations, and some are likely to remain unresolved throughout a Masonic career, not only through a lack of guidance, but very often because of misdirection from those who perhaps should have known better. Oh my goodness. In this technological computerized era of ours today, the search for spiritual values and need to make some sort of daily advancement in Masonic knowledge must surely create the earliest case of difficulty for the new entrant. With daily pressures from businesses, reasonable family demands on time, unremitting repetition of ritual and procedure at lodge meetings, which become just demonstrations of varying feats of memory or proficiency for brethren so engaged, it is quite understandable if the new entrant stifles the natural thirst for knowledge from the onset. It is quite understandable if the new entrant stifles the natural thirst for knowledge from the onset. Well, Roy, you're giving it to us unvarnished here this evening. The history, it is quite usual for the history of Freemasonry to be brought into question. What is the source? Does it have its roots in Mithraism? Is there a connection with the Essenes? Has it anything to do with the building of the pyramids or ancient Egypt? Did it really begin with the building of Solomon's temple? These are typical questions, and the early writers on the background of Freemasonry will certainly have helped the literal minds of today. They have traced the path of Freemasonry through all stages of history, real, legendary, and imaginary. And we can look with amazement at the sheer invention displayed in the list of grandmasters credited to it, starting with Adam. There you go. I'm not going to argue with any of this. Folklore, creation legends, instruction by catechism, ethical standards. These things have not been the special property of any one country or any one civilization. Parallels in whole or in part may be found in all ancient mysteries. An examination of a few facts is probably the quickest and most effective way of focusing Freemasonry of today. And for that purpose, I have listed seven. First fact, that stonemasons practiced a skilled trade requiring a standard of communication that would enable them to execute the designs of architects. Second, that castles, cathedrals, and ornate structures resulted from their combined efforts. Third, that the stonemasons took their meals and held meetings in huts on sites where they worked. Fourth, by the late 14th century, the working masons had formulated a code of regulations and produced a system amongst themselves to protect their interests. Fifth, in the mid-15th century, two livery companies of masons were listed among the London guilds. Sixth, that the working masons, or operative masons, later accepted among themselves others who were not working masons, but were known as accepted or speculative masons. Possession of a copy of the old regulations or charges was justification and a kind of self-bestowed authority for such a group to be together. And seven, that organized Freemasonry as we understand it today had its modest beginning with the formation of the Premier Grand Lodge by members of four lodges in London in 1717. Seven facts, thank you. This may be an oversimplification, but these are all basic facts and will clear the path for a better understanding of the development of our present system and for us to recognize the elements it contains. A lucid effort. Many manuscripts of the old charges, originals, and copies are still extant, amongst which are the Regius dated in the 14th century, the Cook 15th century. Common to the majority of the old charges is the linking of biblical characters with the craft of the masons, the recording of Old Testament legends and biblical tradition, the Christian invocations, and in this sense, literacy and liturgy were close companions. Much of the basic ritual used in Freemasonry has been built up from elements in these manuscripts, constitutions. What better vehicle and what better setting for the Mason craft could have been called into use than the temple erected by Solomon for the glory of the Holy Name? Masonic historians of the 18th century were certainly not disturbed by anachronisms. Decades, even centuries, could be discarded quite freely if it suited their purpose to make biblical characters contemporaries. And what was good enough to record in the old manuscripts was quite later acceptable for ritual compilers and writers on Masonic history. When we're talking about doctoring history, compressing time, telescoping time. Synod convention, we didn't invent it, been going on for thousands of years. The wider membership. If Christianity had such a strong influence on those early days, how then did Freemasonry grow to such worldwide proportions, opening its doors to men of other religions? Students claim that this really springs from the erection of the Premier Grand Lodge in London, the originators of which were quite unconcerned with Freemasons meeting together in other lodges in England, and for that matter, in any other part of London. They elected an overall Grand Master to control the inaugural four lodges and, with definite leanings toward the convivial, expressed the intention of having an annual feast in the hope that they would be able to attract the patronage of a noble as their Grand Master. We have no record of their proceedings until the first minute book, which commences with the meeting of 25 November 1723, 6 years after they banded together. The only record of the inauguration of Grand Lodge in 1717 is given to us in an account by Anderson in the second edition of the Book of Constitutions dated 1738, 21 years afterwards. I'm going to give you a little bit of a sidebar here. No offense to Brother Roy Wells, but there is reference to the meeting. There's newspaper references to it. Roy Preps didn't have that at the time. But if you take a look, and I think the paper was called the Gazette, it has paragraphs on the lodges and the attendance and the business of the meeting. Well, it wasn't like they were, you know, building big, thick walls around the ideas. But I digress. The first edition of the Constitution, dated 1723, gives a clear statement of the attitude toward religion. I'll try not to butcher the old language here. A Mason is obliged by his tenure to obey the moral law, and if he rightly understands the art, he will never be a stupid atheist nor an irreligious libertine. But though in ancient times Masons were charged in every country to be of the religion of that country or nation, whatever it was, yet 'tis now thought more expedient only to oblige them to that religion in which all men agree, leaving their particular opinions to themselves. That is to be good men and true, or men of honor and honesty, by whatever denominations or persuasions they may be distinguished, whereby Masonry becomes the center of the union and the means of conciliating true friendship among persons that must have remained at a perpetual distance. It gives us reason to be friends. This appears to be one of the charges subtitled Concerning God and Religion. Pull out your blue book, section 6. Reverend James Anderson was junior grand warden in 1722, and Dr. Desolier, the grand master in 1719, have been credited with the development of greater religious tolerance and wider scope for membership. Both played an important, very important parts in the formative years. It is reasonable to say that Anderson's Book of Constitutions influenced the course taken by Ireland and Scotland. Not exactly sure, Roy, that the fellows of Ireland and Scotland would agree with you, but I digress. The Grand Lodge of Ireland issued instructions that each lodge under their jurisdiction was to obtain a copy, and later, when they compiled their own, it was based largely upon Anderson's work. Scotland was influenced by a visit of Desolier in 1724 to a lodge in Dunblane. I think Dunblane was up in the Kingdom of Fife, an old part of Scotland, up in the Highlands, if I'm not mistaken. Somebody have to take me to task for that, please. Where he was presented with a copy of the English Constitutions. The course taken by the three sister Grand Lodges was mainly determined by the same publication, the first Masonic book published in the USA in 1734, was Benjamin Franklin's reprint of the same work. On irregularity. The rapid spread of Freemasonry must have created its own form of difficulty in management for their premier Grand Lodge. Military lodges and colonists carried Freemasonry into other lands. I think that's us. And when you look on the atlas back then and you look under other, you would see what? That great lump of forest and water over there. Soon to be called the Dominion, soon to be called Upper and Lower, and soon to be called Canada A. Military lodges and colonists carried Freemasonry into other lands, and the second and third quarters of this 18th century became a fertile period for irregularities. New degrees, pseudo degrees, and new orders emerged, and in this wider field, a lucrative market arose for the sale of broadsheets against the craft and for so-called exposures, some of which have greatly added to our knowledge of the pattern of development or parts of the ritual. Among the earlier exposures, we have something called a Mason's Examination. That was printed in 1723. The following year, the grand mystery, and in 1730, the important mystery dissected, which a lot of us have heard about. I say important because it is the first printed account of the Hiramic legend. Hiram Abiff. A spade of a, because there was a time when the Enochaic tradition was being considered, the antediluvian kind of thinking. Enochaic, Noah. Do some homework there. Scratch the surface there, old boys. It's all there. It's all there. I say because it is the first printed account of the Hiramic legend. A spate of exposures appeared on the continent between the years 1730 and 1760. We must have been, well, there were no commercials and no late night television. It must have been this intrigue. I mean, what more? You think about it. Back in 1649 had led to the regicide, the beheading of Charles I. And right after, you know that led to civil war and the Cromwell, the new order army, and where for the very first time it wasn't rank. They sort of said they were getting rid of the twits, and they had like well-trained people running the army. But we found that under Cromwell, things deteriorated rather rapidly, even though he did crown himself, which I think is very generous. Yeah, give yourself a field promotion there, buddy. But I'm not talking about the courage of his son, Charles II, 11 years later. You know, step back in. The country says we have to, we're nothing unless we have some organization that we can, that makes sense to all of us. So they put the king back in power. Now, he wasn't exactly a star, but you think about it, they had, the cathedral, after the rebuilding, the last great fire, they had two great fires in London, the last one was 1666, and the city, we gave a reason for the city to be rebuilt. Wren was having a field day. But when that was done, it was done. You had a lot of people, a lot of builders that were, it's like, well, what are we going to do now, boys? Well, we hadn't invented hockey rinks, so they couldn't come over here to Canada just yet. I don't think they had the sense of building the stands for football matches in Newcastle or Edinburgh. But Manchester United was just a sparkle in somebody's eye. Madrid was probably chasing goats around off the pitch, Anyway, along we come with an order that is making sure. And remember, is after Charles II, there were still battles based on, the separation, the need to separate king and religion. And then, the fusion of the monarch, the divine right, these are things, some of them the people realized served purpose, but there had to be accountability and containment. And then there was always the threats of battles going on. About that time, just around 1720, was about the time when the Dutch sailed up and surprised the English and wiped out their fleet. Well, I don't think that didn't upset the boys. So here we are, we're sitting in the pub, and we've invited the other three lodges, and they've sort of straggled in. They haven't just come out in great numbers, and we're sitting down saying, hey, boys, how about, you ever thought we're all Masons? Why don't we try and do something collaboratively and see what we can do with this? These are great ideas, and you guys are all wonderful, and you're all doing your own ritual, and it's all good. But, if we could really pull it together, well, the rest of the boys sitting around say, what the hell, why would we do that? Well, once a year we'll get together, we'll have a few pints and a pie. We'll have a few laughs and give us a reason just to catch up. So sign me up, says everybody. Sure, sign me up. I'm great. And then a few years later, we send off our fellow, De Saulier, and he heads up to Scotland. Now, Desai is no slouch, eh? He goes up there and visits a few lodges, and let's consider that the guy is persuasive, and he's probably not ruthless, and he's not English, so you can get over that, you know, I'm a Scot kind of thing. And it's like the guy's saying that, you know, I'm an international, and this is a great idea, and why don't you guys start your own, you know, and join us? So they say, right, then bloody hell, we'll do that. So they did. Oh, and he didn't write it all down, did he? Oh, my, did we forget something about merit? Or are we saying we want to write all this down so somebody can remember and blow smoke up our skirt because it was me or him that developed it? Well, he didn't. He just went up there, and a couple of years after he went up there, these guys got it together. Was this an influence? Who knows? Who knows? Did they already, had the idea already crossed their mind? Probably. These aren't daft people. None of them are. They're thoughtful men. They're thoughtful men. They were the gentry, eh? They weren't yet cleansed and uneducated. The people could write. They could think. They could read. Huh? They were talking about ideas passed from mouth to ear. So here we become the fascination. I think it's great. Before Hockey Night in Canada and Dallas and the Dick Van Dyke Show. And so there's exposures and scandal. Well, remember, in previous shows, we've talked about the development of coffee shops in London. So we like to think we're all just whaled and loaded all the time. Well, the coffee shops became meeting places, as you know. Lloyd's of London was an offshoot, developed the largest marine insurance house of face of the earth. Lawyers' offices, lawyers held their office meetings in coffee shops. And for a time, they were, of course, in London, you'd ban women, of course. Over in France, my goodness, they decided women, not a bad idea. But it was a time of great energy, wasn't it? Where people were broadcasting political ideas without battle, without that breath-catching sense that this is tipping the scale and we're going to be led off to some bloody massacre. And here are these boys wanting to meet. So we might want to keep an eye on it. You and I might. Until, and then in 1760, there was a book written. Masonry was dissected, was all the rage in 1730, but 30 years later, three distinct knocks came up. So much for keeping a secret, eh, boys? You want to walk around and listen to the secret. Oh, you know, my wife knows it. Oh, my kid knows it. Oh, yeah, fine. Read the ancient charges. Conduct went around people, not a Mason. And then in 1762, a paper came out called The Jakin and Boaz. Unbelievable. And that ran into many editions and was often used by Freemasons as a manual. We have many examples of this in our libraries all over the country. Far be it from us to publish something. But some scoundrel publishes something. Well, we'll stick it in our pocket and use it. That's a bright lot. It was in the atmosphere of early exposures that Grand Lodge took steps to protect its members and its funds from imposition. Many clandestine lodges sprang into existence. Access to ritual was no problem for the making of irregular Masons. Later on came the charges that Grand Lodge had departed from certain landmarks. Ancients and moderns, huh? What? They had departed from certain landmarks. That they had made a change over of certain words, had discontinued the ceremonial for the installation of master in private lodges, and later still their persistent refusal to recognize the royal arch degree. Remember, back in the day, there were not every lodge could install a master. There were only certain lodges. And the master of the lodge would go there and they would be installed masters and they would do the installation. So, what? So you can see that there was some tensions. Yeah, of course. Prominent among the objectors was Lawrence Dermot, an Irish immigrant who had been initiated in Dublin in 1741. Now, at the last International Conference on the History of Freemasonry in Alexandria, that's in Virginia, that's right outside Washington, there was a great long debate. One professor stood up and hailed this guy. He's just a wonderful man, did all these things. Another scholar says, oh, yeah, and just slaughters the guy with all kinds of nefarious acts and deeds accredited to Lawrence Dermot. So as I read through this, judge yourself accordingly, judge for yourself. He was an Irish immigrant, had been initiated in 1741 in Dublin, reached the chair of his lodge in 1746, and then exalted in the Royal Arch, all prior to his arrival in London in 1748. A rival controlling body, at first a committee which paved the way for another Grand Lodge, was set up for the purpose of preserving ancient forms of Freemasonry. So we have the anomalous terms of ancients to describe a Grand Lodge set up 44 years after the original, which they dubbed the Moderns. This is a fascinating standoff. Pepsi and Coke. Oh, no disrespect, man. My Lord, lighten up. The progress of Freemasonry under each jurisdiction, however, was strong indeed, but the contradiction in terms persisted until 1813. Tipped right off. Lighten up, boys. Like, can you sit down and talk? But anyway, when the two Grand Lodges joined amicably and became the United Grand Lodge, then in 1813, they became the United Grand Lodge of England as we know it today. And the lodge of promulgation that occurred between the deal, shaking the hands, and making it happen is a fascinating part of Masonic history, and I encourage you all to read about it. The back and forth negotiations. So when you look around the lodge, you can see what bits and pieces have to do with the presence of the Irish Freemasonry and the Scottish Freemasonry and English Freemasonry. There are fingerprints and footprints all over our lodge. And we can trace it back to this period, can't we? It's wonderful. And who among all, I should really get the custodian of the work to come and join me on the air. But I would probably be a bit hesitant about what I could ask on an open line, wouldn't I? Of course I would. But around craft ritual, recognizable elements of the ritual can be seen in most exposures. With the settled form that has come down to us, undoubtedly due to the influence of William Preston, as in Preston Lectures. He was initiated in 1762, the period of the TDK and the J&B exposures. We don't have to say those names again. And 3 years later, published Illustrations of Masonry after an exhaustive search and study of all phases of ritual. We owe much of our present ritual to his syllabus of lectures, which followed a coordination of the material that he gathered. In 1787, Preston instituted the Grand Chapter of Herodim, which had the dissemination of knowledge as its main purpose. Man, that must have been an interesting group. The dissemination of knowledge as its main purpose. It's like a school for super teachers, super masons. Wow. Its title is not to be confused with the Royal Arch use of the word chapter. Though warranted as a regular lodge, in effect, it was what we would call a lodge of instruction. In the Freemasons' Vade Mecum, dated 1797, it is listed as follows. And I'm going to spell that for you folks following this with computer access. In the Freemasons' Vade Mecum, it's a hyphenated word, capital V-A-D-E, hyphen, capital M-E-C-U-M, M as in Mickey, and it's dated 1797. And it goes on, it's listed as follows. Chapter of the Order of Herodim, Freemasons Tavern, Great Queen Street, Lincolnshire Inn Fields, third Monday from January to April and from October to December. Dine at 5, exactly, chapter opens at 7. Visitors admitted by tickets, which may be had by applying to any member of the chapter. C. See Preston's Illustrations of Masonry, 1796, at page 342. It is interesting to note that this entry is followed by a list of lodges of instruction which are classified under days of meeting, and that Sunday is divided into afternoon and evening meetings. Preston's lectures had many Christian references, but most were deleted when the lectures were revised in 1813 by Dr. Hemming. This work forms the basis of the craft lectures that are taught in the Emulation Lodge of Improvement and sometimes worked as demonstrations in lodges or lodges of instruction. Their value is in the explanation of much of the ritual, and it is from the reasons supplied we can understand the thinking of the compilers. A ready example of association may be seen in the following snippet of catechism, which has this to say of Knox. Question: how did you gain admission? Answer: by three distinct knocks. To what do these three distinct knocks allude? To an ancient and venerable exhortation: seek and you shall find it, ask and you shall have. And I won't get into the last one for obvious reasons, brother. Another sign is knocking at the door. I'm not going to talk about the knocks, but this is from the Sloan manuscript in 1695. The references to the knocks are in there. And I know it's public record, but I'm a little, if you don't mind, there's just some things that we don't talk about at large. Knocks are also quoted in A Mason's Examination. Recognizable differences in rhythms existed before the development of the three-degree system, but all are quoted within a Masonic context. They were there waiting for adaptation. So I suggest, and Roy suggests, reading your Book of Constitution, your Book of Ritual, Lectures of the Three Degrees, the Bible, or the Volume of the Sacred Law, Freemason's Guide and Compendium by Bernard E. Jones, that's an interesting book, and the Mason's Pocket Reference Book by Pick and Knight. I've got those just out of reach here on the bookshelf. I might try and, I think I've used them here on a few nights. And the Pocket History of Freemasonry, it's very easy reading, and the title is self-explanatory. And the Freemason's Book of the Royal Arch, again by Bernard E. Jones. And one that really, really, I've got to dust it off, by Joseph Fort Newton, called The Builders. It's uplifting material that will serve as a standard by which many of the spiritual type of writing may be measured. It could save some brethren being led into the realms of fantasy. Now, when we come back, when you come back and visit me, I will read to you some material. We'll get into some material by Lionel A. Shimungle. He's Queen's Counsel and a lawyer, and he's writing an article in 1973 entitled The Edinburgh Rebellion, 1808 to 1813. So I don't want to get into that right now. I want to thank the most worshipful, the Grand Master of the Grand Lodge of Quebec, Paul H. Mayotte, for his hospitality the other night at Argentua Lodge number 67 in La Chute, Quebec. I had the pleasure and honor of accompanying the Grand Master and our Grand Master on a return visit that they're identifying as Hands Across the Border. Last year, our Grand Lodge invited, and this year, their Grand Lodge reciprocated. And it was a table lodge. Enormously a wonderful meal, seven-course meal, but the hospitality was top shelf, just top shelf. I had the pleasure of sitting next to a past Grand Master of the Grand Lodge of Quebec, most fascinating person, as you can imagine. So if you get a chance to visit lodges in Quebec, I would recommend. The hospitality is unbelievable. And just for little fun facts out there, yes, they're still creating lodges where English is spoken, but the exciting part is we're seeing the development of Francophone lodges, which is fantastic, where the brethren can gather, the ritual has been translated into French, I think this is remarkable. Of course, everybody's welcome. But, and it, absolutely captivating, kind of a atmosphere was wonderful, wonderful. And to see our grandmasters so, you know, just having a great time, to see grandmasters from two jurisdictions sitting down and having a good time, supported by their brethren, Grand Lodge officers that had traveled from considerable distance to be there. It was really a remarkable, remarkable night. And that had led us, we had, you know, traveled over there from after being up in Bob Cage. And now this is something that you'll find, this is a most staggeringly gorgeous stone building, big, huge thing. The lodge is on the very top, 33 steps to the very top. I'll leave you to the symbolism of that. It's number 268 on the GRC, and it is in Bob Cage in Ontario. Now, Worshipful Brother Peter Ferguson was an incredible host. We just had a fabulous time. Watched the performance of a fellow craft degree. It's a lodge with just wonderful character. And the hospitality was top shelf. Lovely meal beforehand. Nice banquet, I mean. It was the district deputy's official visit. And please make an opportunity for you to see masonry as it happens in that part of Ontario. I get the feeling that masonry in central, so part of central Ontario is quite distinct. I know it is in the Ottawa Valley. Always similar, but these fellows have their own characteristic way of handling things Masonic. And it is a good education for any one of us to experience, I would say. Now, thanks for being indulging me. You've indulged me with my rant. Did I ask you questions? I probably ask you, you know, for some advice. If I haven't, that's obviously going to come up. And you can tell when I'm offering you quotes, you can tell pretty much what I've been reading. The Souls of Men, To Try Men's Souls. I've been reading that. That's by co-authored by Newt Gingrich. I saw Newt Gingrich speak a couple of years ago and I was captivated. I didn't want to like him, but man, I had to. I had to. He's a brilliant man. Brilliant, very approachable guy. I just think the world of him. So all of that means that I was introduced to the work of Thomas Paine. This is a fellow that Washington had to convince not to pick up a weapon and join them after he had to rally his troops in the winter. Farmers, they needed to get home. They'd been fighting for a couple of years. They were hungry. They were out of equipment. They wanted to go home and they deserved to go home. And yet Washington, Brother Washington, put the question to them and they stood up. And on that night, I think it's quite right that there was a turning point. But as he said to Thomas Paine, I can't do this alone, Thomas, I need you. Thomas Paine was an incredible writer. He could convey the idea and the spirit of independence in ways that Washington couldn't. He was a pamphleteer. And he wanted to, you know, he was a noble man and saw that people were suffering and knew that Washington needed another soldier and was ready to make that sacrifice. And Washington stopped him and convinced him that the progress of the entire idea was largely dependent on Paine being able to tell the story. And he did. Independence is my happiness, and I view things as they are, without regard to place or person. My country is the world, and my religion is to do good. That's Thomas Paine in The Rights of Man. To argue with a man who has renounced the use and authority of reason, and whose philosophy consists of holding humanity in contempt, is like administering medicine to the dead, or endeavoring to convert an atheist by scripture. He wrote that in a book called The American Crisis. give to every other human being every right that you claim for yourself. That is my doctrine. Belief in a cruel God makes a cruel man. If there must be trouble, let it be in my day that my child may have peace. The mind once enlightened cannot again become dark. Be afraid, my brethren, you're bordering on the edge of enlightenment. Once you get it, it's hard to go back and play silly mugger. I know. And you know I mean that in the most fraternal way. Freemasonry has played a significant role in the history of Native Americans since the colonial era, a role whose extent and meaning are fully explored for the first time in her book, Native American Freemasonry. The work's overarching concern is how Masonry met specific social and personal needs, a theme developed across three significant periods of membership: the Revolutionary Era, the last third of the 19th century, and the years following the First World War. Joy Porter places Freemasonry into a historical context, revealing its social and political impact as a transatlantic phenomena at the heart of the colonizing process. She then explores its meaning for many of the key Native leaders over time, for the ethnic groups who sought to make connections with it, for the bulk of its American membership, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant middle class. Porter contends that Freemasonry offered special access to Native Americans through its performance of ritual, an assertion borne out by a wealth of contemporary manuscripts, newspapers, pamphlets, Masonic sermons, orations, and lodge records and writings by Masonic historians and antiquarians gleaned from archives in New York, Philadelphia, Oklahoma, California, and London. Through these documents, she demonstrates that over time, Freemasonry became a significant avenue for the exchange and perhaps even co-creation of cultural forms by Indians and non-Indians. Joy Porter is an associate dean and senior lecturer at Swansea University in Wales. She is the co-author of Competing Voices from Native America, Fighting Words, and the co-author of the Cambridge Companion to Native American Literature. So, for the price of giving a call to the box office at Brock University and having a ticket set aside, you can join us in the audience listening to Professor Porter. And I'm not going to suggest that it's going to be anything but brilliant, but some of you will remember the first fellow that stepped in for us, Andreas Onnefors. Dr. Andreas Onnefors, from the Swedish Grand Lodge, Professor Onnefors, actually stepped in because the first fellow who agreed to speak at the Sankey lecture unfortunately died before the event. And he had made speaking commitments. This is perhaps why I have such deeper respect. Not only is Andreas Onnefors a brilliant thinker and an incredibly astute historian, but he stepped in for his friend. He stepped in to cover the commitment of his friend. Man. Flew across, came over here, at the very first Charles A. Sankey lecture. No history, no accolades. Heard the idea. Tried to cultivate scholarship in the workings of the context of Freemasonry in a university. To be able to have the objectivity of scholarship as an asset for Freemasons everywhere, and to do it in Ontario, Canada. And he stood up. And then what did we have? Jessica Harlan Jacobs, second year. selected by from the University of Miami, and selected by the student population. How many students are there? 250,000 As the best lecturer, any of you who remember being in the audience, she started off brilliant, and then showed why she was sensational. She got into her topic. She was absolutely remarkable. And at the end, what could you say? She absolutely owned the room. She had a message to say, Builders of the Empire, where she was talking about Freemasons. Onifers tucked into symbolism. He didn't tuck in superficially. There's nothing about Andreas Onifer said superficial. He explained the associations that are made between us and some other nefarious groups around the world. The world is not always kind to us, and you and I know that. This happy dance that we seem to be doing is a bit tends to make us look a bit silly when you think about some of the persecution of Freemasons that's happening on the face of the earth right now. Syria passed a law that if you're a Freemason, you could be sentenced to death. They've got their own problems now, so I'm not going to pick on them. But Andrea's work was intense, and we sat there wide-eyed wondering. And I almost forgot that we had that captured that on the first film. So you can sit there and go through it and dissect it as well. I think everyone should. And Dr. Jacobs was startling with the amount of detail and the parallels she drew between the development of the empire and the spread of Freemasonry. And Bullock, in his work, explained how he explained about the period of Masonic history around the time of Morgan, the so-called Morgan affair. But he left us, I know he did a departure at the lecture, but his book was remarkable because it revealed that, in fact, it was the, what would you say, the bigger than life, maybe even the bordering on arrogance of Freemasonry at the time, and that led to a public outcry and backlash that led to the process of the political arena that continues to exist in the United States to this day. The electoral process, the openness and transparency of the elections. And to think that we, you know, our word or not, we, our order played a role in that. Something noble came out of something ignoble. And so, you know, then those great scholars passed the torch to, pass the square, excuse me, to Joy Porter. And knowing that Dr. Porter is comes with some pretty serious credentials, she is speaking very clearly to us about the connection, our context, Native Americans and Freemasonry. We're probably all going to collectively be a little brighter and better informed after we've listened to her speak, I have no doubt. Next year, the keynote speaker has already been arranged. I think you mark your calendars for the 30th of March, 2014. And we're going to be listening to Dr. Renee Lafferty from the Brock University Department of History. Now, some of you may have seen her and heard Professor Rafferty do an introduction last year for the Sankey speaker. And some of you who are fortunate may have also caught her performance, her talk at the Educational Day in Ottawa that followed in June. She is a consummate speaker and very engaging, very engaging. I understand from the Department of History that she's sharpening her interest, has a keener interest perhaps in Freemason topics of Freemasonry. Again, these are topics and speakers that aren't selected by by Grant Lodge or you or I. These are all selected by the faculty of the Department of History. And you can see, of course, they talk. They want advice. You know, these are not foolish people. The department is quite capable scholars. And you can see the caliber of the scholarship that they're able to produce for this initiative. How could you and I not think that this is far-reaching? Grandmaster Raymond Daniels did plant seeds, as he often said, that will grow into oaks under which, you know, future generations will sit. This is staggering. When we're finished in 2014, if Dr. Rafferty doesn't have us all on our feet, I'd be most surprised. And then 2015, mark your calendars right now, probably around the end of May, 2015 in St. Catharines and Niagara, the International Conference on the History of Freemasonry comes to Canada. And we are all going to have an opportunity to sign up for that conference series. 3 days of the most intense world-level scholarship. This is not for the Masonic faint at heart, and this is not a Masonic event. These are the finest Masonic scholars in the world, and they're bringing it from Belgium, from California, from France, from Hungary, from England, Scotland, and of course, from Canada. We have Scott Kenny from Memorial University, a sociologist at Memorial University, who's speaking this year in Edinburgh. And I'm hoping to have a bit of a chit-chat, and perhaps we can entice him to come to Ontario. But for all of you and I, we have an opportunity that has been supported by our Grand Lodge. This is like being at the Met when Pavarotti walked on the stage for the first time, or Beverly Sills came out when she was still, I wouldn't say that she was nervous, but when she was perhaps not as familiar with the stage as she was later, or when Paul Henderson scored the big goal against the Russians, or when Gretzky was 17 years old and he signed his first professional contract, or, you know, we're going to see something remarkable. And the richness of history in Ontario, the richness of Masonic history in Ontario, is hard to deny. You know, from when we go around to Amherstburg and Pelee Island and with our brethren in Erie and Windsor, we are introduced to history that predates the Dominion. If we sit down with our fellows in Quebec, we are part of history that predates the Quebec Grand Lodge. And we can sit and still visit today the lodges that that petitioned for the development of the Quebec, or the Grand Lodge of Quebec. Our history is not in living memory anymore. But apart from all of the other things going on, it teaches us about the development of wonderful ideas. It teaches us about communities finding a gravitas, grounding themselves and making statements of permanence. It talks about the commitment of you and I. That's part of Freemasonry. Just like what would start in the early communities, often it would be, you think about it, it would be the jail or the school, then the jail, then the church, and the lodge. And perhaps not in that order. But those are the facilities that were often very important. And when communities started to take root, they took great pride in the young women that came to be the school, the one-room schoolhouse teacher, and the minister or priest that came to the chapel, and a repository for people that strayed and did silly things and weren't safe for the rest of us, needed to be kept in custody. And for the rest of us, pulling the community together, before country clubs, before society was established here in Canada, we had masonry. I'd like to think that as the future, in the past, that Freemasonry was a beacon for enlightened men. I don't know how many scholars are amongst us, but I'd like to think that's a direction we would be wise to cultivate. That's why I think I had a really keen interest in seeing what something like a Sankey lecture would do at a university campus. I'm one of those folks, probably like you, that thinks that the principles and values of Freemasonry have withstood the test of time. Nothing archaic about it. I would be embarrassed if anybody suggested that our ideas are the ideas of old men. These are ideas that are as fresh and applicable today as they were when they were developed in times gone by. And it's not times gone by that's important. It's the application in the contemporary environment that's keenly important. 100 years from now, you and I are going to be part of history. I hope, truly, in my heart, that history judges us kindly. But it's not going to happen if we sit on our hands, looking in the rearview mirror at where we've been. Something's changing in Freemasonry. We're evolving, just as we always have. It's not that change is bad. Change is the current. Change is the life stream. Change is the integrity of the order. This is no place for foolishness. We have things that we want to continue to respect in a particular way. It's fundamentally important that we understand our history, that when there are roadblocks, if we have strong personalities, that does never not stop change, nor does it stop progress. Never has, never will. Sometimes we just have to be a bit patient. But when we point to each other and claim that we have difficulty with change, I think that's selling us short. We, in fact, live in a contemporary environment, and we bring the best of the past with us. We don't necessarily travel light, you and I. We have symbolism, and we have ritual and pageantry, and we have friends all over the world. The honor and respect that are due to each one of our brethren is a demonstration of our commitment to Masonry. So I'm done speaking today. I'm not near done with Masonry and not near done with bringing ideas to you. But I've gone through a pile of material that's been on my desk for this evening's show. I hope that you're committing acts of random Masonic kindness at least every day. And if you're not, shame on you. It's not that hard. Come up with something. But the best you can do is if you do it when nobody's watching and nobody really knows it's you doing it. That is what inspires the rest of the brethren, and you know it. Oh, somebody's watching. Make no mistake. Somebody's watching. When you think that nobody's watching, your actions are governed by an ethical, moral sense of belonging. That's what's building the Masonic character in each and every one of us. I hope you continue to thrive. I hope you continue to support one another. When you see us in our regalia or before lodge or after lodge, look for the Mason in them. Look for the Mason. Don't look for the differences. If you look for the Mason in the man, you'll find it. It's remarkable what you find when you go after it. I have to go now. I hope you'll come back and join me. I hope to see you in St. Catharines on Sunday afternoon, listening to Joy Porter. I'll try to be a little calmer then than I am about it right now, because generally I don't want to make a fool of myself. Thank you very much for joining me, and I sincerely, brethren, I appreciate the support. Take care of yourselves, and I look forward to seeing you again real soon.
Every time we say goodbye, I wonder why why the gods above me, who must be think so little of me, they allow you to go. When you're near, there's such an air of I can hear a lark somewhere begin to sing about it. There's no love song finer, but how strange the change to minor. Every time we say silently the senses abandon their defenses, helpless to resist the notes I write, for I compose the music of the night. Slow, gently, night unfurls its splendor, tremulous and tender. Hearing is believing, music is deceiving, hard as lightning, soft as candlelight. Dare you trust the music of the night? Close your eyes, for your eyes will only tell the truth, and the truth isn't what you want to see. In the dark it is easy to pretend that the truth is what it ought to be. Possess you, open up your mind, let your fantasies unwind in this darkness which you know you cannot find, the darkness of the music of the night. Close your eyes.
Power of the moon.